Let me say a quick word of prayer and we can jump in. Heavenly Father, we are grateful for your word, grateful for the Hebrew Bible, just these books that you gave to ancient Israel. Pray that our time today of discussing the historical books would be insightful for all of us, that we would have the opportunity to bring up questions that we have, and all of us walk out of here knowing more about these books, feeling more comfortable approaching them, and more able to get to know you, that we might love you better and love our neighbors better as a result of all that we discussed this morning. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So our first week together, we talked about basically the big picture of the Hebrew Bible. And then last week, took some time on the Torah or the Pentateuch. So today we're going to move into the next chunk of the Hebrew Bible, which is in our Bibles. So as I mentioned in the first week, we read essentially the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible. These are organized as the historical books. So everything, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Samuel, Kings, the Book of Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah. As you might imagine, we can't cover all of that today. So we're going to look at two chunks of the historical books. One of them is what the Hebrew Bible, so if you were to open your table of contents, what the Hebrew Bible would call the former prophets. So we're going to look at the former prophets in a few minutes here. Those will be the books of Joshua, Judges. Now you'll notice Ruth isn't in here. The Greek Bible moved Ruth out of this section called the Writings and stuck it here after Judges because Ruth takes place maybe around the Judges' time. And then Samuel and Kings. So we're going to spend a fair bit of time looking at these books called the former prophets in the Hebrew Bible. But they're really historical books about really the entrance to Canaan all the way to the end. Think of it as Israel enters Canaan here and then gets kicked out of Canaan here at the end of Kings, right? So it's that whole period in the Promised Land. And then we'll also take a look at 1st and 2nd Chronicles because I think those two books are interesting as they relate to Samuel and Kings. It's kind of a rewritten version of that history in another period of time. But before we dive into these books themselves to make sense of the historical books in the Hebrew Bible, it's worth taking a look at the history period as it takes place in the world of ancient Israel. That's why I've got this little map of ancient Middle East. You'd be amazed how difficult it is to find a map that covers the broad swaths of biblical history in the sort of major empires on Google. I thought there'd be 100 different maps that show this, but there are not. So, sorry, the map is only so-so. But the story of Israel, as we think about the, like, we're talking about this from a historical perspective, not so much from, like, the way the Bible unfolds historically, really begins in ancient Mesopotamia. So that's, as we probably all learned way back in history class, Mesopotamia, this land between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, and of course over here is the Mediterranean Sea. So this is the basic area where Israel is going to settle eventually. So as you're working through Genesis, the stories there, the primeval history we looked at, Genesis 1 through 11, is very heavily influenced by Mesopotamian stories. And those stories of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, really reflect the life of individuals, people that we can see in other documents that in this period called the Middle Bronze Age. You don't need to know all of that, but about this period around 2000 BC, right, the life of Abraham really does look like what we see in other documents from that time period. I mean, you can look at economic documents, marriage contracts, all this stuff. And what's going on in the Abraham story really does kind of parallel, echo what's going on in that time period. But when we get to the book of Exodus is when we really start tracking with what's happening in ancient Middle Eastern history. We've reached something called the Late Bronze Age. And at that time in ancient history, there was a collapse. There were all these old empires. Egypt was super powerful. There were Mesopotamian kingdoms that were super powerful. Up here in Asia Minor were these people called the Hittites that ruled really, you know, all the way down into Israel and other areas. And everything just fell apart. The whole world, kind of, you know, if you think about the Middle East as the world, it just fell to pieces. And all of a sudden, all these new little people appear, these new little kingdoms, these new people groups that we've never seen before, never heard of. So one of them, you know, are these Philistines, you know, they came out of nowhere. lots of different people migrated across the ocean. The, you know, historians will say something awful happened in Greece somewhere out there, some kind of famine. We don't really know. Something pushed these people out, and they migrated across the sea, attacking Egyptians, attacking Hittites, taking over land in the Middle East. So when history kind of, the lights turn on again after this kind of dark age, there are all these new people. Philistines, you know, all these Syrians groups, all sorts of, you know, Arameans and others. But one of those people who appear on the scene are Israelites. All of a sudden, the lights turn on, and there's this people called Israel kind of living here in Canaan. So this is this period of kind of migration and movement and change. The world kind of wakes up with the Philistines down here on the coast. So they'll be a constant thorn in Israel's side, right? People of Israel in this kind of general area. There's over here, across, if we, this map is not to scale, as you might imagine. with the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, right across here, you'd have the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, all these little kingdoms. They were not there before Egypt, and the Hittites ruled this area. And then all of a sudden, they show up. So Israel and all their key neighbors, in, you know, key players in the biblical story pop up in this period. And for a few centuries, all these states kind of live in a state of conflict with each other, tension, sometimes peace. They're all kind of vying for growth and power, as states are wont to do. But then everything changes. And about the, you know, the 8th century, and into, well, really the 9th century into the 8th century, these people we hear of in the Bible called the Assyrians become the power, the big power, right? So the Assyrians kind of have their base of operations out here in Nineveh. Think of the book of Jonah, some other places. We'll talk a lot about Nineveh. So as you can see on your map, on the handout, the green there is what eventually becomes the Neo-Assyrian Empire, which ultimately includes all of Israel. So this, it's not like the Assyrians appear on the scene and instantly have this full empire, but they're constantly moving across Mesopotamia down, putting pressure on all these Aramean kingdoms up here, putting pressure on the Israelites. So as you read, especially the book of Kings, you'll see this also through the book of Isaiah. We can talk more about that next week when we jump into the prophetic literature. Assyria is this constant threat throughout the historical books of the Bible. And so all these little kingdoms, the Israelites, of course, right, eventually Israel will split in half into Israel and Judah. Israel and Judah are, you know, making political alliances with Israel. Hey, come beat up our enemies, right? We don't want the Ammonites causing us trouble, so Assyria, come on over here and take them out, help us. So over and over, they invite the Assyrians in to help them out. All these shifting alliances through the historical books. But as any giant political power tends to do, the Assyrians, well, they just take everybody over eventually. They take control of everything. So these little kingdoms think they can use them, but that doesn't end up working out. So Assyria essentially takes over the whole Middle East and is a big part of the biblical history. But then there's this sudden collapse, right? Very surprisingly to the biblical writers, to a lot of people, the Assyrians fall. And the next kingdom to take over is, based a little further down, is the Babylonians. Now, if you're a historian looking at this period of time, Assyria is a much more important empire than Babylon. The Babylonian Empire lasts for maybe 100 years, maybe. The Assyrians were there for many hundreds of years in the Middle East. But from the biblical perspective, so if you're reading through the Bible, the historical books for sure, but especially the prophets on into the writings and other sections of the Bible, Babylon is the most important empire because the Babylonians send the kingdom of Judah, where most of the Bible was written, into exile. So Babylon is just this huge presence in the mindset of God's people. It raises all these questions we'll talk more about next week of, like, is God really God if he lost the war, right? Jerusalem got conquered, his temple's destroyed. I mean, what's going on? So Babylon plays a huge role in we could say, in the Israelite psyche. But, you know, in the Bible, the construction of the Bible, Babylon plays almost an outsized role. So they rule the Middle East for about 100 years or so. And then they get conquered by people further to the east. This is the constant story. So, you know, we could say the Persians come next, take over the whole Middle East. And that's really important for the biblical story, because the Persians will send the people of Israel back home. We'll talk a little bit about that when we get to discussing Kings and Chronicles here. But the Persians have a totally different policy for how you manage an empire. Right? The Assyrians said, you conquer people, you tear families and cities apart, and just send them everywhere out through the empire so that they can't form a rebellion, right? If people can't understand each other and can't relate to each other, they're not going to cause us problems. The Babylonians said, we want a little more stability, so we're just going to uproot you and move you to a new place, but you can all stay together. So that's why the people of Judah are able to form the Bible. And actually, really cool. I won't get into it. We have documents from Babylon of the people of Judah and all their marriage documents and trade documents and all sorts of things going on there. It's really fascinating. But the Persians said, you know, we want the people that we rule to be a little happier. And we're still going to be in charge, but we'll send them home. Let them do their own thing. Let them live their life. People will often say the Persians, I think this is a little exaggerated, but they valued diversity more than other empires. Okay. So they send the people of Judah home and say, go ahead, rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple. That is a huge change for the people of Judah. And forms, so in this period, a new chunk of the Bible gets written. There's just a totally new outlook on who's God, what's happening in the world, right? Oh, maybe God really does have control of the story of history, right? He's brought us home. His house is being rebuilt. Our nation's restored. Maybe we need to think about how we conduct ourselves so that we don't end up in exile again. So this imperial story, the historical context for the people of Israel and Judah really changes through these Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian periods. And then finally, the Persians fall to Alexander the Great. There's a little bit of biblical literature written in the Greek period, not a ton in the Hebrew Bible, but there's a few books we could point to that were probably written then. And this is probably the period when the Bible itself comes together. The Greeks have moved in. They are trying to make everybody Greek throughout the Middle East. Right? Greek becomes the language of the whole Middle East, everything going on here. And there's probably a sense in which the Bible itself gets formed as a resistance education project, where the Israelites say, hold up, we're not Greek. This is not who we are. And we're going to put together all our books that tell us who we really are, and that is our Bible. These books existed, but they weren't. You couldn't just pick up a Bible and take a look at it, right? It's a collection of scrolls. And they said, no, this is our curriculum for who we are and how we live. And so that is a very rapid introduction to the history of the Middle East as Israel kind of lives in that history. But before I move on to setting some of these books in context of that history, any questions that anybody has before we jump along?
That was very helpful.
I'm glad. Really glad. Yeah, and it's, I think as someone who's looked, you know, studied the Bible a lot and studied history a lot, it's just interesting how the two, I'm not saying, oh, the Bible is super, you know, anti-historical, but the perspectives are different. Assyria is really, really dominant in the historical record and super important. But when you look at the Bible, Babylon is the dominant figure. I mean, look at the New Testament. Who shows up in the book of Revelation? Babylon, right? Babylon's the big bad guy. Babylon is the name of the ancient empire that was so dangerous. Right? That remains part of the way of thinking in the Bible because of the way Babylon related to Judah and conquered that kingdom. All right, so I'm going to erase a few things, but we're going to take a look now at the former prophets. So we're going to look at this, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And while I'm erasing here, one thing that's, you'll find that I, unless I'm pointing to a specific chapter, will rarely ever say 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel or 1 Kings or 2 Kings. And the reason is, those were actually single books. So Kings was one book, but it's long. And so somewhere along the way, it didn't fit on a scroll. So it had to get divided between two pieces of, you know, goat leather, right? You know, you can't write the whole book on one piece. So you got to divide it in two, and that's where you get 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. They're really written as one book, but they didn't fit. Because no one had invented the book yet. They had scrolls. You couldn't just add a few more pages. So they needed giraffe leather to write these books. So I'll talk about Samuel and Kings, and it's really important if you decide you really want to dig into one of these books. If you're trying to outline a book and you try to outline 1 Samuel and not the whole thing, your outline's not really going to make sense because there are important parts of the narrative that will cross over from 1 Samuel to 2 Samuel or in any of these books that where there's two pieces. That's what's going to happen. So these former prophets are the first and largest chunk. So these books here are the first and largest chunk of historical books in the Hebrew Bible. Students of the Bible have identified some really consistent themes in Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. Whether these were written by one person, nobody really knows who wrote these books. They were almost certainly written in the exile. So people are in Babylon assembling these books, you know, gathering documents, resources to assemble them, to edit them. Whatever the story was, it's difficult to figure out exactly how. But these books clearly were put together in the period of the exile, or very shortly thereafter. But I would say, in Babylon, these books come together. And it's a story to say, who are we, and how on earth did we end up here, right? We're not home anymore, and how did we get here, to this place, far, far, far from where we were supposed to be? And so you'll see over and over some consistent themes. One of the biggest themes is God's grace, yes, but Israel's constant failure and constant turning away from him. Right? There has to be an explanation for how you ended up in Babylon. And if the explanation is, God's not strong enough, God's not good enough, he didn't win the war, like, that's not a great story. So a narrative that makes a lot more sense is, God was so good and gracious to us, but we continually turned away from him over and over and over again, and it starts from the beginning. Right? Joshua, the book of Joshua is all right, right? It's right. This is the book about how they take the land of Canaan, they enter in, but even there are issues, right? There are chapters where you see the people rebelling against God, and, you know, not following the regulations he gives that are pretty detailed about how they're supposed to conquer Canaan. And so Joshua takes leadership of Israel after Moses dies. In the first half of this book in Joshua, we see the conquest of city after city in Canaan. And then the second half of the book, you know, more power to you if you can enjoy it, but it is really the people of Israel saying, like, here's our boundaries, right? Okay, there's the sea here, and the tribe of Dan starts at this point and goes over to here and to here to here. And they'll draw boundaries for each of the tribal allotments. It's basically like trying to draw a map with words instead of pictures. So that's why the second half of Joshua can be a bit dry and boring. It was practical in a time, but, you know, imagine trying to describe the border of Maryland without drawing a picture and having to use our words to say, well, you know, here's Maryland. Oh, and by the way, we've got 49 other states to describe. You know, it's tiresome. So I don't expect any of us to, you know, derive a lot of joy reading the second half of Joshua, but the first half of Joshua has a lot to say about how the people were moving, growing, responding to Joshua's leadership, and of course God's guidance as they entered the land. And so, in Joshua, things go okay. There's some ups and downs throughout that narrative. But then we hit the book of Judges, which I actually really enjoy Judges. And I think Judges, if you're familiar with, on the literature side, Susan as an English teacher, I'm sure you probably, did you ever read Things Fall Apart in high school?
I think I missed that one, but yeah. I'm familiar with it.
That should probably be the title of Judges, right? Things Fall Apart. So the people have made it to the land, and everything looks pretty good at the end of Joshua, the way that it's told. And then Judges starts off, and we see, no, everything is not good. They haven't taken the land the way God wanted them to, and every
Everything they do, they keep failing, rebelling against God, and turning away from him. And there's actually this standard repeating cycle in Judges. So the people will turn away from God and start worshiping other gods because they left the Canaanites around them. And they decide, hey, these people have some good ideas. We'll worship these other gods. See how it works. Then God hands them over to be subject to these people, right? So they get conquered or get ruled over by these people. So the Israelites repent. They say, oh, we made a mistake. We need to turn back to God. And God raises up what in Hebrew is called a judge. Think of them more as a military leader. They're not sitting in court in a black robe. These are really military champions who are going to lead the people to get them rescued. And they redeem the people of Israel. So there's this repeating cycle. In fact, as you open up chapters 2 and 3 of Judges, the narrator sort of establishes a couple quick little cycles of this to show you this is the pattern to expect. And so you start to see it on some larger scales with like the Gideon stories, if you're familiar with those. And then they move on to some bigger narratives of Judges rescuing the people of Israel. But as you work your way through Judges, the cycle repeats, you know, over and over and over again. But then you start finding that there are pieces of the cycle that don't happen. You know, maybe, for example, in the Samson story, we get over here and the Israelites, they don't repent. They never turn back to God. And Samson is kind of a crummy hero. He doesn't really care to distance himself from the Philistines. He's in love with a Philistine woman and keeps falling for her over and over again. And the cycle actually falls apart as you work your way through Judges. The narrator is like very intentionally saying, there's a way this is supposed to work, even though they're rebelling against God, and this whole repentance and rescue thing is falling apart. And you hit the end of the book, and there's absolute chaos at the end of Judges. They are cutting people into pieces. They're stealing wives from each other. It's you read the book, and it is abysmal what's happening at the end of Judges. So in Judges, we see there is a big problem with the people of Israel. They've been given the land. God has brought them where he promised, and they have totally failed. So we enter the book of Samuel, and God raises up another judge, Samuel. And he's the sort of starting figure who leads the people, some interesting stories about him at the beginning. And there's just this big problem in Israel, which is the people keep failing. They keep falling on their faces. They keep turning away from God. And even Samuel, this great judge, his sons, they fail, right? His sons are awful people, you know, stealing sacrifices and all kinds of stuff in the temple. And so the Israelites finally come, and the sort of the big story of Samuel itself is Israel says, we need a king, right? If we're going to do this the right way, we need a king. But the people of Israel do this. It's a really interesting story. You know, we don't have time for it, but take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 8, and you can see this story, how it unfolds. The people of Israel are like, we want to be like all the countries around us who have a king. And, you know, that'll make us great. And Samuel and God are kind of like, that wasn't exactly the way, you know, Samuel says, they're rejecting me as their judge. And God says, no, they're rejecting me. you're just a little guy, Samuel. They're rejecting me, God, as their king. And so there's this kind of inauspicious beginning to kingship. And so, as you might expect, the first king, Saul, he starts out okay, but he ends up being a disaster. And Saul is my least favorite. Actually, the book of Samuel is a troubled book for me because Saul was chosen as king because he was really tall. No. This is Samuel is a book where all the tall guys are bad guys. Goliath, of course. and so Saul, he looks like what a king should be, right? He's tall. He's strong. He's a military leader. He's all these things. And he's a total failure in the end, right? He can't follow God. He disobeys Samuel, all sorts of things. So then God says, all right, Israel, your king didn't really work. But I've got this other guy who I'm pulling out of, you know, out of left field. We've got this short little guy who's not a military leader. He's nothing. He's a shepherd. You know, he's a nobody. This guy named David. He's the one that God then brings into the role of kingship. And so the book of Samuel is this conflict, right? There's a rise and fall of King Saul at the beginning. And then this very intense period where Saul and David are vying for power. Right? We know, based on God's promise, David will eventually be the king, but it's going to take some time. It's a process, and Saul keeps hunting him down for chapter after chapter after chapter. So David finally, you know, gains power over the people of Israel, and he's a better king than Saul, but even David is a failure. And the book of Samuel is not shy about that, right? You could probably name a bunch of stories, but of course the classic story is the David and Bathsheba episode. And so David has this rise to power, then there's the Bathsheba adultery murder incident, and what happens to David at that point? Everything is just a disaster after that. David loses the kingdom, his son takes over, he's in exile, wandering around, trying to hold his band of people together, right? So the king's behavior there really guides the history of the people and where everything goes. So David is, near the end of 2 Samuel, there's this struggle for David to retain power. And then that book wraps up with this four-chapter epilogue of some kind of, it's an odd way to end Samuel, but there's some just odds and ends, poems about mighty men and David's census and some other things to wrap up the book. But Samuel is really about establishment of the monarchy and really identifying David is the royal house, right? God promises that you are going to be the king of this people, and I'm going to have one of your sons on the throne forever, right? You are going to be the royal house of my people, is what God says to David and to his family. And that then leads us into the book of Kings, where we see all the other kings, right? Everybody after David, from Solomon, David's son, all the way to the exile. And Kings focuses on a repeating theme again, pretty similar to Judges, but not such a strict cycle. But for Kings, it's if you've got a good king, things go well. If you've got a bad king, things go badly. And right after Solomon, of course, the kingdom of Israel, very critically, divides in half. Right? So we have the 12 tribes, sitting here along the Mediterranean in Israel, and Jerusalem's maybe down here, and Solomon's son Rehoboam takes over, and he has some terrible advice that he follows, and the kingdom divides in half. So you have the northern kingdom, which confusingly is still called Israel, and the southern kingdom called Judah, which has Jerusalem and the temple within it. So Judah is really, if you think about the people of Israel in the Bible, we're really mostly talking about the people of Judah. They're the main characters in the Bible. This is where David's house and his descendants will rule. The northern kingdom of Israel has to get creative because they don't have a temple anymore. They don't have a lineage to David anymore. There's a lot that they have to come up with to maintain their sort of, they continue to worship God, but they have to worship him at new sanctuaries with new, they come up with these golden calves. Ever hear of that before? all the way back in Exodus, right? They come up with these golden calves that they're going to worship. And so this division of the kingdom in half is really important. And what you'll see through Kings, right, that story of a good king leads to a good outcome, bad king leads to a bad outcome. Well, in Israel, there is no good king. They're all bad. And so the story in Kings is, everything that happens in the north is bad, 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 worse, bad. In Judah, it's up and down. It's a roller coaster ride. Some of the kings are good, and things go pretty well. Some of the kings are awful, awful, awful people, and everything falls apart again. And what's interesting from a historical perspective here, again, if you weren't reading the Bible, but we're looking at historical documents, the kingdom of Judah is super insignificant, right? From a historical perspective, people know that Judah's there, but they're teeny tiny and not important. Israel actually kind of shows up on the global scene. This is the bigger country of the two, the more politically important. There are kings of Israel who show up and, talking to Assyrian kings, usually giving them money and stuff because the Assyrians took over. But they appear on the global scene in a more powerful way. And so it's interesting, the biblical writers are really, to me, that's important because we see the biblical writers are not getting at, okay, who's richer, who has more land, who has more soldiers, but in terms of their faithfulness to God, right, and following God, and this more important sort of historical line, what's going on, and things are not going well in the north. But that story that Judah has is things are sometimes going a little better down in the south.
Question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Was Israel the portion that worshipped the golden calf, not Judah, or was it all throughout both kingdoms?
So what happens is Jeroboam is the first king of Israel, the northern kingdom, and so he sets up two new temples, two new sanctuaries. So he sets one up here in a city called Dan, and another one about down here in a city called Bethel. He has these two golden calves. And sometimes people get unclear, and they're like, wait, they're worshiping different gods? No. They're worshiping Yahweh, the God of Israel, using these calves in a way God said, right, don't make any graven images, right? And there's a strategy here, right? It's, you can go to our northern end or our southern end and worship God and stay here in Israel. Just don't go back to Jerusalem, right? Stay up here. Stick with us. So they built these sanctuaries on the two borders of their kingdom in Israel. The people of Judah still had the temple there in Jerusalem that they would go to and continue to worship at.
Okay.
That was their sanctuary, and they didn't have, well, some kings decided to get creative and make things to stick in the temple, but not from day one did they have these golden calves set up there. Does that get to your question?
Yeah.
So I've kind of walked us through the main sort of story as it unfolds in Kings. And as these kings go from good to bad, good to bad, good to bad, the story even breaks down in the kingdom of Judah. Eventually there's this king named Manasseh who is so bad, so awful, that God says, look guys, I can't overlook this. You are going into exile. And Manasseh's followed by some other good kings, like Josiah is one who's really a good king there near the end of Kings, but it's like, you're not good enough. You can't overcome how bad this king Manasseh was, and you're all going to be sent into exile. And that is the story that Kings is trying to tell. It's like, how did we end up here? How did we end up in Babylon? And so the book ends with the people sent away from Judah. Jerusalem's destroyed, the temple's destroyed, everything's totally obliterated. But the book ends on a note of hope. Right? The last king of Judah shows up in the very last verses of Kings. He's invited to Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor of Babylon. He's invited to the royal table and is sitting there in the royal court eating food with the king and giving us some little inkling of hope that David's house, the royal house, maybe isn't done. Maybe history isn't finished here. The people don't know what's going to come next, but there's still a little bit of hope, even as the book of Kings ends, sort of trying to explain the disaster that happened, but also leaving the people with some hope looking forward. So we've walked through this sort of very quick summary of these former prophets. Any questions, comments? Any thoughts before I keep moving along here?
So does that bring us to kind of the beginning of the Babylonian Empire, where they say, where they send them?
Yes, okay. Yeah. So that's pretty early in the Babylonian period.
Okay.
So they'll be there, I mean, the Bible gives us this kind of rough number of about 70 years or so that they're in exile. There's some important prophetic passages that end up being more or less relatively accurate. They're in exile for a little less than a century or so.
But while they're in exile, are those two, Israel and Judah, the people united in exile?
No. So the people of Israel actually got conquered by the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, their policy was take a nation that you conquer and just scatter them everywhere so that they can't rebel against you. So there were 10 tribes in Israel, and they're sometimes called like the lost 10 tribes, mm-hmm. right? These people were scattered around throughout the Middle East. And so a lot of the northerners just kind of lost their identity, their connection to who they were, because they would marry, you know, Arameans, they'd marry Babylonians, they'd marry Assyrians or whatever. And, you know, there's this intermixing, so you lose your identity.
So that's the 10 tribes that are lost.
Yeah. So, but then the people of Judah are sent as a population into exile. Of course, I could refine that and say the important, powerful, political elites and wealthy people are sent into exile. you're just a farmer in Judah, they're going to leave you there. And, you know, you keep on farming and doing your thing. But anyone who had any power was sent away.
Yeah. But together, but as a group.
Yes, exactly. So we have documents from their community in along the Euphrates. It's really pretty fascinating. There's some pretty recent discoveries and things that are coming to light. It's really interesting stuff. So I want to make sure we have time to look quickly at Chronicles. So I'm going to very quickly jump across a few key themes as you're reading Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. Just give you a couple more hints about how to read these books. And this is going to sound like super academic scholarship, but don't worry, you don't have to remember the word I'm going to use. These former prophets are called in scholarship the Deuteronomistic history. And you might say, wow, that's a big word. Don't worry about it. But you can see in that word, Deuteronomistic, Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy. So as you read through these books, it's almost like whoever was editing them, collecting them, putting them together, was writing on one side and had the book of Deuteronomy open on the other side. Mm-hmm. And all throughout these books, there are key themes from Deuteronomy that play out throughout Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. It's like beating the same drum over and over and over again. And there are a lot of different themes we could point out, but I'm just going to draw attention to a couple. And one of the most important is worship at Jerusalem. Throughout Deuteronomy, God says over and over, I'm going to establish a place for my name to dwell. There's going to be a place where I dwell. I make my name dwell in this place. Obviously, he's talking about Jerusalem and the temple as the author of Deuteronomy is putting that together. This is the temple, though he doesn't say it in Deuteronomy. And that is so important throughout, especially the book of Kings, but all these books. Anytime a king decides to worship somewhere outside the temple, that's a huge condemnation of that king. And that's a huge issue. That's true also even in other, right, Saul, some of Saul's problems in Samuel are he doesn't worship God in the way that God asks him to, that he doesn't follow exactly what God tells him to do. So that's one of these key themes through these books. Another key theme is that a faithful king. I've got a long chunk of Deuteronomy 17 on your handout. I won't read it right now, but there is a clear description of what the king of God's people is supposed to look like. And from the very start, after David, it's quite fascinating. The author of Kings is clearly looking at this passage as they describe Solomon's reign. Right, the real problems with the kingdom begin with Solomon. Right, it says, I'm going to say, right, the people have a king, and he shouldn't acquire many horses for himself. Go read Solomon's reign in 1 Kings, and he's got thousands of horses and has these huge stables. Right, what else is going on here? He must not acquire many wives for himself. Solomon has 1,000 wives. And it's like, hold up. All right, whoever's describing Solomon has the book of Deuteronomy sitting right here in their other hand, and they're saying, here are lots and lots of problems, right? Flashing red lights saying, warning, warning, warning. Things are not going the way they should. And so these books repeatedly look back to Deuteronomy to say, this is the way things should be or should not be. And that's kind of the guidepost for what's right conduct or wrong conduct throughout these books. And so if you know Deuteronomy really well, you just see it instantly as the authors are pointing things out throughout these historical books. And then a third really important theme, later in that Deuteronomy 17 chapter, there's a lot of description of prophets, these prophets that God will send to guide the people. And throughout these historical books, especially from Judges, Samuel, and Kings, not so much in Joshua, prophets show up. All right, a king rebels, a leader does something wrong, and there's a prophet right in his face saying, quit it. Right, turn back to God. Start doing what you should do, whether that's Samuel in Saul's face, getting after him. Nathan comes after David as soon as he murders Uriah the Hittite, commits adultery. There's Nathan telling him this nice parable about a guy stealing some poor person's sheep and killing it. He's like, guess what? You are the man who did this awful thing. Right? Over and over, the prophets are in the face of the king saying, turn back to God, do what's right. And they're calling them to these Deuteronomic principles. Right? They're calling them back to the book of Deuteronomy, to the law of God. So you can see what I mentioned last time, even within the Bible, the Torah is kind of the core. We're here in the historical books, the very next section of the Bible, and they're already calling people, look back at the law, look back at the Torah. This is what's essential for you to follow God and to be his people. And so there are a lot of key themes throughout these books that really hold them together as one piece of literature that you'll see. And hopefully a couple of these are helpful to you. I know that's super fast, but I do want to look a little bit at Chronicles before we take off today. So the book of Chronicles is essentially a revised version of Samuel and Kings with a giant genealogy tacked on the front. You know, anyone who picks up Chronicles to read it is going to say, man, this is the most boring book I've ever read. Because you have something like 9 chapters of genealogies at the beginning. Okay, so why is the book set up like this? So I've mentioned that the former prophets were probably written in the exile. There's a story they're trying to tell. How did we end up here in this disaster? Chronicles was written in a very different situation. Almost certainly in the Persian Empire, maybe the late Persian period, maybe the Greek period. The people are back. The temple is rebuilt. Jerusalem's restored. They, at some level, are able to govern themselves. Things seem to be going all right. And so Chronicles is retelling the story. Who are we now? Right? And so, of course, that who are we is really important in those genealogies. Right? If I show up in Judah, you know, I can't just say, hey, I'm a Judahite too. It's like, okay, show me your genealogy. Right? Show me your lineage. We need to know who you are, who we are as a people, because we got dispersed. We went through this horrific disaster, and we need to reestablish who we are as a people. So those genealogies to you and me are really dull, boring. Like, I'm not going to whitewash it. But in the ancient world, genealogies are really important about establishing who you are as a person, who you are as a family, who you are as a nation. So that was critical to them. But Chronicles retells this history of Samuel and Kings after those genealogies. And it does it in a very, very, very positive way. All the bad stuff is cleaned out of Chronicles. Oh, I shouldn't say all. A lot of the bad stuff is cleaned out. David and Solomon, they don't do anything bad in Chronicles. Mm-hmm. Nothing. I mean, you read Samuel, and David is doing all sorts of horrible things. We talked about Bathsheba, but he murders people. He does all kinds of, you know, wild things in the book of Samuel. In Chronicles, David's just a good old guy, right? Everything's great. Solomon, no thousand wives, no idols, none of all of that. Solomon looks like a great guy. There's no idolatry going on there. And Chronicles retells the story in a way that really cleans up the history of God's people. It almost entirely ignores the Northern Kingdom, right? They just appear as these kind of like secondary players, secondary characters who aren't very important. They're just kind of neighbors of Judah. Well, this makes sense, right? The people writing Chronicles are there in Judah. They're the people of Judah. Israel's hundreds of years since they've been a thing, right? And anyone from Israel, I mean, there's very few people who would have been from Israel as a part of the restored Judah, because they had been scattered by the Assyrians. In fact, they were considered outsiders, the northern kingdom of Israel. You kind of see that attitude really play out in, we see it in Ezra and Nehemiah, which we don't have time to talk about today. But you also see it in the New Testament, where who are the Samaritans?
Yeah, right.
The Samaritans are kind of remnants of the old northern kingdom, and they're terrible people, right? If you're a Jew, you hate the Samaritans. They're awful people, right? Because they don't worship God, right? All kinds of things are wrong up there, right? That the seeds of that exist here, even in the Old Testament.
So in that genealogy, the Israel tribes wouldn't be included.
So the funny thing is, those tribes are included in the genealogies.
Okay.
And there's kind of a disconnect there, right? So all 12 tribes are accounted for in the genealogy. You'll see in the way the genealogy is structured, it highlights the important tribes, which of course are Judah, and for the chronicler, Levi, the tribe of Levi. So the Levites were the religious functionaries in ancient Israel. They managed the temple. They, of course, provide all the priests. And the book of Chronicles focuses intensely on all things religious. Sacrifice, holidays, singing at the temple, all kinds of things that just don't appear elsewhere in the Bible. They're all over the place in Chronicles. And that is almost certainly because the temple's been restored, And there's a sense of, we need to figure out what it looks like to worship as a people in the temple. And after all, how did they end up in exile? By not worshiping at the temple, by worshiping in the wrong way. Chronicles is coming in trying to say, we got to fix what went wrong before. Which is why this history is kind of being whitewashed and reprocessed in a new way. And so the Levites are all over. It's kind of interesting. The Levites show up 100 times in Chronicles. They show up 3 times in Samuel and Kings. Right? The chronicler knows the books of Samuel and Kings. They get quoted. They get, you know, there are texts that are copied out of it, which, I mean, that's standard history writing back then. But Chronicles wants to do something new. And so as the chronicler describes the kings, they don't, David and Solomon look good. The other kings, they're a little better than they might be in the book of Kings, but they're organized in a sort of standard process, right? Everything good is at the beginning, and then there's usually this turn, but he did this bad thing. You know, this thing happened. And maybe if you were a really good king, there's no bad chunk, but there's this organization of so-and-so became king. Here's all the good stuff he did, here's the bad stuff he did, and then he died and was buried with the kings in Jerusalem. And it goes over and over and over through this kind of pattern and cycle of all the different kings. And Chronicles builds this narrative to present a really hopeful, forward-looking story about the history of Judah. So the book closes, and it's important to remember, this is the end, if you're a Jewish person reading the Hebrew Bible, this is the end of the whole Bible. Right? These are the last verses of the Bible. I think they're on your handout, 2 Chronicles 36. Mm-hmm. This passage I'll go ahead and read, right? The Bible ends with these words. In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, in fulfillment of the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia, so that he sent a herald throughout all his kingdom and also declared in a written edict, thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, that is, like he says, Yahweh, right? Capital L-O-R-D. Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. So the story ends with this note of hope. The people are going to be restored. They're going home. They're going to rebuild everything. They've been purged, purified by the exile, and they return to a land purified by their time in exile. And so the Hebrew Bible ends on this really positive note here in Chronicles. There's hope. There's a second chance, an opportunity for restoration, which is where the chronicler is really looking to, you could say, rewrite their history, rewrite the story in a way that is like, okay, if we're going to do this right this time, we need to worship God rightly. We need to follow kings who are good. We need to do this the right way this time, which explains a lot of how, you know, we don't have time to get into all Second Temple Judaism and everything, but explains a lot of how the Jewish people unfolded through the centuries leading up to the New Testament. Why did the law and obedience become so critical to people like the Pharisees, right? It's, we still remember, we went into exile because we didn't follow these laws, right? We were punished in horrible ways because we didn't do what we needed to do. And so the law and being strict about all these sort of different procedures in the Torah became so critical to the Jewish people. And then Jesus hops in the New Testament and says, hold up. you know, the law is great, right? You know, Jesus loves Moses, but we got to remember this whole grace thing. There's more to life than just the law here. But you can see how, based on that history of exile, deportation, right, the people would develop this story about themselves as they continue to tell that through the Second Temple period. So I have just run through tons of stuff. Talk. Any thoughts, questions, or anything?
So when you say the Bible ends on that, the Hebrew, so the very end of the Hebrew,
No, this is just my English Bible. But but if I had a Hebrew Bible, yeah, Chronicles is the last book in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible. It's the end of the writings section. Chronicles is included in those writings.
So then who's in the books right after that?
So,
after Chronicles.
Well, see, the way the Hebrew Bible is organized is you've got your first 5 books are your Torah, that's the same. Then your next books are the prophets. And included in the prophets are 2 sections. One is what we looked at today, the former prophets. Joshua through Kings. The second are the latter prophets, which we'll talk about next week. That's Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the things we think of as the prophets, right? So the latter prophets come next. Then they have a section that they call the writings, which is really just the everything else section.
Okay, and they call it writings.
It's the writings. It's, well, it is part of the Bible, but it's Psalms, Proverbs, Job, all the wisdom literature is there, Ruth, Esther, Daniel's in there.
And Chronicles is coming at the end of the writings.
The writings end with Chronicles. Okay. It's oddly, Ezra and Nehemiah comes before Chronicles, which is weird, because historically it's after Chronicles. But Ezra and Nehemiah's in there, which again, a fun fact, I didn't mention that, but Ezra and Nehemiah is one book. Your Bible divides it to Ezra and Nehemiah. Mm-hmm. That's one book, again, that got split in half. The writings just end with Chronicles. So the books are just in a different order in the Hebrew Bible, and it ends with the book of Chronicles, okay. And this note of hope.
I was just fascinating, though, that those 10 tribes, and we always hear about the lost tribes, but they came from Israel, part of the kingdoms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the Samaritans are the only ones that are identified afterwards.
Yeah, they identify with those tribes. The reality is the Samaritans are, could be anybody. You know, they were other people from all around Middle East were settled there, so they identify as people who trace their heritage back to Israel, but they could be Arameans, they could be Assyrians, they could be who knows. Yeah. But their personal history as they tell it goes back to the Northern Kingdom. Yeah. And we don't have time to look at it, but a fun activity this afternoon. I gave you a few passages to compare Chronicles and Kings.
Yes, yeah.
I would encourage you, take a look at that. It's a fun comparison. You can see how Chronicles is reading Kings, but retelling the story in a new way. I picked some very traumatic passages where there's like wild differences. But there are other passages where it's a little more subtle. But you can see how the story is retold in a new way. For a new purpose, which is a lot about how we think of that as not being historical, but history writing in the ancient world was different than the way we do it today. And so it's the way they did it back then. Yeah, maybe not. Yeah. All right, well, thanks, everybody. I know we're approaching 10 o'clock here, but appreciate it.